What is up, everybody? I am Charlie Marlowe. That is the great Brendan Schaefer.
Careful.
This is Low Hanging Fruit. I think it's episode 12. We'll check on that. Brendan, how are you doing, buddy?
How the heck are you? I feel good. I feel good. Glad to be with you this week. You didn't duck me. You didn't cancel on me. We're doing the podcast, man. That it's a great week to be alive if we're doing a podcast with Charlie Marlowe.
First of all, we should never always start like this, but I never duck you. Hey, I'm traveling. Look, I was at the Cleveland
I
Guardians
heard.
home
Watching
opener.
the
They
eclipse.
had the eclipse. The
Yep.
eclipse was there. It was totality for 4 minutes. It was a good time. So I got back, what, 2 nights ago? I got to watch and listen on the radio was fun to the Sonny Gray game. So I was locked into the last two of the Phillies games against the Cardinals. So basically, let's start there. We'll do it again. We'll work backwards. Phillies series. A lot to get to, as Martin Kilcoyne likes to
I
say,
love that line
Brendan
too.
Schaefer.
Yeah.
So the fight in Phils, what did you think? Give us your take on that three-game set.
I think that the Cardinals could have swept this series. It wouldn't have taken much for them to have done so. You have the overtime game on Monday. They get the point against Philadelphia, which is good. With playoffs coming up, no, that's more of a Blues take. They go into extra innings and couldn't quite get it done. And then on Wednesday, you have a pretty solid pitching performance. I know everybody's beaten up Pallante. I think what people should probably remember is that at the end of the season, when you look at every single MLB team and you sort their bullpen ERA, nobody's going to have a zero ERA. So sometimes relievers are going to give up runs too. And yesterday, the relievers gave up a couple of runs. And so the Cardinals lose that game by one. But I notice a trend, Charlie. They keep scoring three runs, and that's not enough runs to win games. So it's not that they're playing terribly, and we'll talk about Victor Scott and sort of the rotten day that he had on Wednesday, but offensively is still kind of the drumbeat that I want to pound today because I feel like this team was built to score runs and just have a solid enough pitching staff to support those runs, and they're doing it on the pitching side. They're not really doing it consistently enough on the hitting side, and that to me is the story right now for the Cardinals, especially when you talk about the big guys, Nolan Arenado, Paul Goldschmidt. Those numbers, you figure they're gonna come back to earth a little bit, come back to the median that we expect from those guys. But when it hasn't happened so far, I think that's why you're looking at 6-7 as we talk here on the off day.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that yesterday's game was probably the first game or the game where it was really impactful where the Cardinals beat themselves in that game. And look, in terms of weather and all that, I was going to go to the game actually with my son, take him to his first game ever. When I looked at the forecast,
Yeah.
plus I was coming back in town, I had a lot of work to catch up. And I'm like, looking at that forecast, it looked like the type of game where not fun to play in. You're kind of always just wet and uncomfortable. You saw Lance Lynn with the belt buckle. You're out there. I mean, he's got his glove on his head. It's constantly raining. There was nobody in the stands. So that first ball, you know, I understand to Victor Scott, you know, that's got to be an error. I think he catches that ball in better weather conditions. That started everything off on a negative. On a negative side of things for the Cardinals, and they weren't able to catch back up. There were more mistakes. Really, really bad game, obviously, for Victor Scott. And if you want to kind of start there, it happens. He's a rookie, first time in the big leagues. But this was a game the Cardinals probably should have won. And you said they could have swept the series. Definitely could have swept the series. You can certainly make the argument they should have won the series. Yesterday was really the game they gave away, and it was a rough one for Victor Scott the second.
It was a weird game because at no point watching that game did I feel like the Cardinals were going to win it. But you can look back at all those individual moments and say they had it right there for the taking. And yeah, Victor's error costs you in the first inning. Lance Lynn gives up a couple of unearned runs. Lance Lynn has this thing going, and this I can remember from 10 years ago when he was with the Cardinals. He wastes a good number of pitches. He had the four walks yesterday, and so he only gets through five innings on 95 pitches. I think he threw 52 strikes. When he's attacking the zone and has his stuff working, he's really tough to beat. Yesterday, by kind of throwing too many pitches out of the zone, he beat himself a little bit, but still pitched really well. Like, he didn't give up any earned runs. There's no argument to be had there. You would have maybe liked yesterday to have been a day where he gets through six just because of the way the Cardinals had to use their bullpen Monday with extra innings. And then Tuesday, you know, backing up Sonny Gray, it's going to be a bit of a chore because he was on a pitch count. So that might, if they would have maybe gotten one more inning, maybe you don't go to Pallante. Maybe, you know, things could have gone a little bit differently. but still pitched well, right? I think on the Victor Scott front, it's the error, it's the base running gaffe that happens in the eighth inning when then the Cardinals do have a rally. You get an RBI hit from Arenado, which has been a bit of a rarity, and that would have probably been an additional run if that bottom of the eighth plays out the same way and Victor Scott is on base instead of in the dugout after making the faux pas on the left turn. So I felt like yesterday was really the first day, and we can get into it a little bit more with the news reported by Katie Wu that Lars Nootbaar is expected to join the team on Friday in Arizona, but it's catcher Pedro Pájez that is expected to be the corresponding move going down, not Victor Scott. A lot of Cardinals fans look at that batting average for him, sub 100, and then you add in a day like yesterday where the two things that he's supposed to be solid at, which is fielding and base running, go against him, and then it was kind of a popular, well, see, we told you he needs to be sent down. I almost think that sends the wrong message of, look, if you're going to send him down at some point, I understand the offensive numbers are what they are, but I'd almost like, and it sounds like the Cardinals are going to, sort of stand behind him for the time being and say, look, you had a bad game. Those are going to happen. And we still believe in your skill set and your ability to kind of overcome that. But it was costly for the Cardinals yesterday. The offense continuing to not go was costly for the Cardinals yesterday. And yes, a series that they absolutely should have won, because you certainly got the pitching, I think, in all three games to be able to win two of three and to just come up short. And now you're on the wrong side of a 500 record. Is, you know, it's got Cardinals fans feeling some kind of way because they remember last April when things didn't go too well, and people want to see a winning record and off to a good start on the season so that we don't have to even think about maybe this season going sideways on them too.
Yeah, with Victor Scott, I saw you got a nice little debate with our guy Kyle Reese on Twitter about kind of his development.
Yeah.
And I understand it's easy to have the big reaction like we all do after yesterday, because it was so glaring that it was a bad game for him all the way around, defensively, base running. You mentioned, I mean, slash line, he's batting 91, on base, .163, slugging .136 for a .299 OPS. We all know that can't continue. Now, when you're talking about development, he is getting a lot of playing time. Now, after a while, I mean, you can't have a guy for a month straight batting .091.
Right.
The fact that he's out there playing and learning, I like. I understand both sides of the argument. My thing with Victor Scott, if you were to send him down after yesterday, it's not just yesterday. It's more big picture offense. And I always say with these guys, if you can't handle the adversity of being sent down after 2 weeks in the big leagues, when you are hitting .091, I don't know, and I'm not saying this specific to Victor Scott, but I don't know if you have the mental toughness to ever make it in the big leagues if you can't overcome a rough two-week stretch, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I think that would extend to a rough month, right? Like, I understand that you don't want a guy hitting 091 for a month. The Cardinals might end up having that because I think Victor Scott, at least according to Katie's reporting, which we trust, is going to be on that. He's on that plane. He's in Arizona. He's going to be in the lineup for at least a couple of the games this weekend, you would think, and going to continue to play center field. I would think that happens unless it just becomes untenable where it's clear that, okay, this is getting to him a little bit. He's now making errors in the field more frequently. Like one error, like Ollie Marmol said yesterday, it's his first error. He's going to make more of them. That's just baseball. That's the way it goes. And I think the Cardinals had the right approach to that. I think it just sends a little bit, like if your take, and this was Kyle's take, and I understood it the whole way through. He didn't think Victor Scott was somebody that should be brought up in the first place. The Cardinals did it a little bit out of necessity. I said, let's go ahead and see. Put his feet to the fire and see how he comes out of it. Maybe he ends up looking great. Offensively, there are definitely strides that need to be made, but I've also made the argument that other guys in the lineup haven't looked great offensively either, guys who have been in the league for a decade. So it's not exclusive to Victor and to beat up on Victor alone of, well, he's not hitting. Yeah, he's hitting worse than those other guys, which I understand, but that's still something that, you know, the entire lineup is working through. My thought would be what he's provided center field defense yesterday notwithstanding is what the Cardinals wanted. It's why they brought him up. It's why they committed to Tommy Edman in center field before the injury. So I think if you were to now, as a result of only yesterday, say, we have to abandon ship, Lars Nootbaar is going to be the center fielder, and we're going to play Burley in left and Jordan Walker in right, and who cares about outfield defense and having the best alignment out there? I think that would be a mistake. Now, if the Cardinals internally, we find, you know, let's say an alternate universe, it was Victor that's going down for the Nootbaar return, and they tell us, yeah, this has been in the works. We kind of knew before even Wednesday's game that this was going to be the plan. then that's one thing. I just thought if you're going to do it, reactionary to yesterday is probably not the way to send him back. And so now, you know, let him play through that a little bit. If it doesn't go well and we're a couple weeks long and you can see around the horizon that Tommy Edmund is coming back, maybe then you say, all right, now we'll start this. We're going to have him go to Memphis and get some seasoning. Maybe Michael Siani plays some center field, giving him a look and giving him an opportunity. He's looked good defensively as well, so maybe there's not that big of a drop-off. My whole thing is I don't think the Cardinals have to keep Victor Scott up for the whole year at this point. At first, I was watching the defensive plays and saying, hey, if this is a defense you're getting, that's the guy that I want behind this pitching staff. But even I would say on Monday and Tuesday in the Philly series, there were some routes that he took where you could just tell maybe a little bit of discomfort. He was making up for it with his speed and athleticism. But if even that part of his game at times looks a little bit spotty, I would say, yeah, there's going to come a time where you do send him down more likely than not, unless the turnaround comes. But I would like to just see what he's made up a little bit this weekend and even in the next couple of weeks and say, maybe he has some adversity, and how does he respond to that? That's what the Cardinals always like to talk about with young players. So I actually think I'm cool with them keeping him up, particularly after what happened Wednesday. I made the case that if Wednesday was a normal 0-for-3 and he doesn't make any errors, I'm almost a little more understanding of maybe you go ahead and make that move if you want. I think it kind of sends the wrong message to do it now, though, and if development and psyche and those things are something that people do have concerns about, I agree with you. If you can't handle 2 weeks and it affects you for the next decade, wrong line of business. That's not Victor Scott. That's just generally speaking. I think now, though, you go ahead and let him play this out and see if he can respond to what happened on Wednesday. And I like that it seems like the Cardinals are going to give him that chance.
Yeah, I guess what I would say is it's not just the bad game. It's the offense, it's the bad game, but it's also the pending transaction. You know, I would hope the Cardinals, whatever their line of thinking was in terms of Nootbaar coming back, who we're going to send down, I would hope they would just have stuck with that regardless of what happened in one game.
Agree.
You know, like, I don't think it was a, we're going to send down Victor Scott when Nootbaar comes up. Oh, now he had a really bad game. We can't send him down.
No.
Because it's going to mess up his psyche.
They weren't going to send him down though. They don't want Lars Nootbaar playing center field, right? Like,
yeah.
They want him in left because they believe having somebody like Edmund or Victor, or even if it ends up being Siani for a bit, that is more valuable to the team because they have a pitch to contact staff. Miles Michaelis is going to have a better year if you have somebody with great range in center who's elite, comfortable at the position. Lars Nootbaar could be fine. He could be serviceable, but then you're also having a downgrade in left field because you're playing more Burleson there. Maybe you're playing more Donovan there and he can handle it, but he's more of an infielder who is just so athletic he can play outfield. I think the best case scenario is Nootbaar stationed in a corner outfield spot, and then everybody else around him, I think, is better for that because it allows them to prioritize defense in the outfield. So I agree. I don't think they were ever going to send Victor Scott down after for Lars Nootbaar because they play different positions in the way the Cardinals wanted to play out. Wednesday didn't change that. And for me, that I know that long run, it's not sustainable to hit 091. I'm glad that Wednesday didn't cause a jerk reaction by the Cardinals to say, oh, suddenly this is untenable, because what kind of message would that send? Yes, 2 weeks, you should be able to overcome that. But if it's, dude, you were so terrible in one game, you're not allowed to make mistakes or you're gone, that I think could linger with a player the next time he does come up. I think the Cardinals are handling this well, and it's not easy to do because you got a guy hitting 100 in your lineup. There are definitely some uncomfortable feelings about that, and rightfully so.
And there's a lot of guys who are struggling. Maybe not to the level of Victor Scott, but overall,
and they're not batting ninth either.
that's true. Yeah, and they're not getting paid. Well, those guys
$700,000. You know, yeah,
$25 million plus whatever it is. So, Cardinals are 23rd in baseball right now in OPS with a 642. We're 13 games into the season. I'm not going to make any big conclusions. I mean, even a month in, but certainly not a couple of weeks. But there are some trends that you don't love. And clearly, when you're talking about Goldie and Arenado, and those are your big money guys, your cornerstone guys, both off to slow starts. But I'll tell you what, you know, Victor Scott is a different conversation for me because to me, he was only on the team to start because of injuries. So,
right.
You know, we're talking about this, but really because there were so many injuries and Edmund and Nootbaar, that's the reason he's up. I'm sure for development, the Cardinals would have loved to start him in AAA and let him, you know, get his feet underneath him and produce well there and see what happens later. So I'll throw it to you and just wondering, you know, who you're most concerned about. You know, Jordan Walker is the other guy that you're looking at. And, you know, it's .162. It's .238 OBP. It's .243 slug. You know, his OPS is .481. This is a guy who has expectations, unlike Victor Scott. This is a potential cornerstone guy. He's off to a really, really rough start. And he had a really bad spring also.
I would say that Walker is more concerning to me than, and yeah, you're right about Victor Scott. Some would make the case that, look, don't hamper a guy's development. If it's just a necessity from injury thing, maybe you should have gone out and added a veteran, added a defense first bat or outfielder, or let Ciani do it. I was okay with them bringing up Victor, so I'm not going to go retrospective and make that claim, but I do agree with what you're saying. Victor's on the team because of the injuries that happened, and they rewarded him for the spring that he had. As far as the guys that are a little more prominent in the lineup, Walker is a concern because I think you're seeing some of what you saw when he was struggling at times last year with just hitting a bunch of ground balls and not making the most of his power. I think he had a track record in 2023 where if you look at the end of the year for a season that was, those numbers were compiled at age 20 and 21, pretty good numbers. So I think you can have faith that he can come out of this, but as a young player, it is a little bit tricky because there's not as lengthy of a track record as there is for guys like Goldie and Arenado. What concerns me about Goldie is just, you know, the bunch of strikeouts, not a lot of power, but also I can think back to other years and remember that he does tend to start slow. So I would say of the three, I'm least concerned about Goldie. My concern with Arenado, he's got a hitting streak. It's like a 9 or 10 game hitting streak. So it's not that he's not hitting. It's that he's not hitting the ball hard. He's not hitting for power. He hasn't homered since August 19th of last year. And I saw a stat today where if you look at his last four or five seasons and how many times he barrels the ball in a given year, it's always between like 34 and 40, 41. This year he's got zero. He hasn't barreled the ball once. I know that we're only 13 games in, but they'll play a series this weekend in Arizona, and then they will be a tenth of the way through the season. Arizona is maybe a spot where he's going to get one. I think Arenado is going to find a homer this weekend. I say that because he almost has to. It's a hard thing to ask for home runs and say, yeah, guys need to be hitting homers. I couldn't go out and hit a homer, so it feels a little bit like, hey, guy's got a hitting streak. Why should I complain about him not hitting home runs? But the way this lineup is built, he needs to hit homers. Goldie needs to hit homers. So I'm concerned about Walker because of hitting the ball into the ground. I'm concerned about Arenado because it's not that he's not hitting, but he's not hitting for any power, and that's a trend you can trace back to the middle of August last year. So for me, I would rank it that way, where Arenado a little more concerning than Goldie, but it's not like you can't pretend that Goldie hasn't been struggling as well.
Yeah, so look, early on, the catchers, you know, Wilson Contreras, OPS pushing 900. Ivan Herrera, arguably the most impressive guy that we've seen, just because we didn't see a ton of him in previous years. And man, everything about this guy, you got to like right now. Brendan Donovan off to a really nice start. You know, Gorman, I think we'd both agree. I don't want to speak for you, but you know, Nolan Gorman's never going to hit 300. Nolan Gorman may never even hit 270. I don't know, but he's bringing the slug to the table. He's hitting home runs. I think for Mason Wynn, you got to be pretty dang happy offensively because that was a big question mark as well. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not big picture worried about Arenado or Goldschmidt being bad. I don't think they're going to be bad. I think even in their worst year, they're going to be league average. And I understand, well, Cardinal fans, that's unacceptable. These guys are making $25, $30, $35 million to make the playoffs. They can't be average. And I think that's fair to say. If Goldie and Arenado are just an OPS plus of 104,
yeah,
I don't think that's cutting it. And look, this is coming from somebody who, on paper, I really liked this Cardinals offense entering the year. And I still do. I'm not going to overreact to 2 weeks. But those guys aren't young. Also, Arenado's swing looks different to me. You know,
it's Goldie's not consistent. Interesting. Yeah.
Arenado's finish looks odd. Goldie, it's so funny because his at-bats were so good opening day. I mean, you're facing Glass now. You're like, oh, we're all stupid. He had a terrible spring. Back to Goldie.
Yeah.
And then boom, it's been back to kind of the spring training Goldie, unfortunately.
Yeah. And the thing with Arenado's swing is like, I'm no hitting coach. And I know everybody on social media likes to kind of nitpick at that. It does look weird and a little bit different and not consistent. And you're seeing that trend of the half swing, where it's like, that's almost pitch recognition to me of which pitch do I want to attack and swing at versus, you know, knowing in time to be able to do something with that pitch or lay off the pitches that aren't ultimately going to be suitable to swing at. So I think he's kind of going through and feeling his way through that a little bit right now. Agree with Goldschmidt as well, having that situation happening for him, maybe to a different degree. But I agree with you. You can't have these guys even be just slightly above league average. Like you said, 104 OPS plus isn't going to cut it. You could go down the list on their rotation and say Sonny Gray is going to have a 2.79 ERA like he did last year. Miles Michaelis in front of a better or behind a better defense, he's going to end up with a 3.6 ERA because it's going to go better for him, the pitch to contact style that he has. Lance Lynn's got a 2.6 ERA right now. Let's say he goes 3.5. Everybody would be thrilled with that, I think, if Lynn gave you that. Mats is probably going to throw 140 innings, 150, not be a workhorse, but he's had some good stuff. Let's say he stays healthy and you go another. It's a 3.5 ERA. Holy smokes, you got four guys, and Kyle Gibson's going to be kind of your number five with maybe a 4.5 ERA. I think Cardinals fans would go, wow, what a rotation. That's better than I could have envisioned. We'll take it. And let's say your bullpen ranks 10th in ERA in the league. Wow, the bullpen's even. If those two have an OPS plus of 104, they're not making the playoffs. You could do all those things, and they could still not be the team they need to be. I think that's how important those two guys are in the middle of the order. Unless everybody else is just hitting above their head, I don't think the Cardinals, designed the way they're designed, can do it without Goldie and Arenado. And that's, I agree that it's not that they're going to hit a 570 OPS like they have now. I don't think that'll be the number at the end of the year. But if it's 732 for the OPS, I still don't think that's going to be enough for the Cardinals.
Okay, so bright spot. Yesterday, you know, Lance Lynn was very good, as we talked about. But I just think, and Kittredge is somebody who's really impressed me. Yeah. He has that big league pedigree where I wasn't really worried. I know coming off an injury a little bit, but that's a proven big league, really good reliever. But Zach Thompson, what he gave you yesterday, you know, 3 1/3, gave up 4 hits, but 6 strikeouts. And we'll see what happens with his role. You know, he's not going to be able to throw 3+ innings. You're going to have to figure out, you know, his rest. You know, can he go multiple innings, take 2 days off, whatever it is. But I just think in the modern game of baseball, you know, it gets back to what we brought up in the first series against the Dodgers with the Ryan Yarbrough. I think having that length guy who really can come in there and every once in a while go 3 innings, but go an inning and 2/3. If Zach Thompson can be anything like he was yesterday, I think that's a really nice piece for the Cardinals bullpen. And also, just because I'm thinking about him as the person, God, if I'm him, if I get sent down again, because, hey, we got to keep you stretched out. I mean, just mentally, that's pretty crushing at this point in his career, especially with what he went through last year.
Yeah, I think that would be a tough pill to swallow for Zach Thompson. I also look at it and go, well, especially after he performed yesterday and the stuff looked good. He was locating well relative to his velocity, though. He's still throwing 90-91, and that's something that they've said, you know, mechanically he's kind of trying to sync things up and it's not where he wants to be, and it's not something that'll happen overnight. So the fact that he was able to work with what he had velocity-wise and be as effective as he was, I get like what the structure of it is like, well, you need somebody to still be stretched out in case there's another pitching injury, and you'd like Thompson to probably be that guy because I think he's done enough to where you feel at least semi-comfortable with him slotting in if needed. It's a hard thing to manage the bullpen with basically one fewer guy because you want to kind of save Thompson for the spots where he's able to go a little bit longer. And you don't know as a manager when those spots are going to come up throughout a given week or a given series. So I don't envy the Cardinals' position on what they're supposed to do with Thompson. I do agree, though, if they send him down, it's going to suck, first of all, because nobody wants to be in AAA instead of the big leagues, especially when they're coming off a game where they did perform in the role that they were assigned. And then the other angle of this is, down there, they've got that automatic balls and strikes, and it's a little bit different strike zone, and that was something that affected guys that the Cardinals, you know, whether it was Dakota Hudson or different guys from last year, they all had like a 5.5 ERA in Memphis, and then they'd come up and they'd be okay, but it was like a weird kind of transition for those guys because there's almost, you have to pitch with like a different set of circumstances in the minors. You don't want to be there, and then you get up to the big leagues and you're trying to adapt to that strike zone. It's almost like from a development perspective, it's tougher for pitchers now with almost like different rule sets between the minors and the big leagues. And I know that that's something that Zach Thompson would not want as the headache. But if you're the Cardinals, what do you do? Because you need that parachute in case somebody gets injured in your rotation in the near future?
So I think bullpen wise, pretty early here. I mean, man, like JoJo Romero the other day, obviously, with the big strikeout and going multiple innings, and you know, Helsley off to a nice start, Gio off to a nice start, as we mentioned, Kittredge, Matthew Libitor is getting there. So I think bullpen overall pretty dang solid. I think you and I both thought they have the potential to have a really good bullpen. And then starting staff wise, you know, Miles Michaelis and Kyle Gibson are the two guys to me that there's just like early on here. I don't expect Matz to always be this good, but when he's healthy, Steven Matz is pretty good. Sonny Gray should be close to Sonny Gray. Lance Lynn, okay, I think we all agree there's going to be a game where Lance Lynn gives up 3-4 home runs. It's going to happen, but right now he's pitching really, really well, and he's run into all the weather and all the delays and all that too. But, with me, it always gets back to that in my brain. Kyle Gibson, to me, always is the guy that allowed 4 straight homers. I'm telling you.
Awful, and it's Charlie.
I think Kyle Gibson and Miles Michaelis, there is so much volatility to their starts, you know? And they both may end up with a 4-5 ERA. I don't know. But it's going to be the Kyle Gibson, I think, where 7 innings really good. Then he gives up whatever it was, the 6 runs. I do think Kyle Gibson, from a stuff standpoint, there are going to be outings like that. Miles Michaelis is kind of the same way. When you don't strike people out and you allow a lot of balls in play, you know, we're probably going to be hearing about soft contact because, look, there's going to be balls in play. All of a sudden, you give up a double in the gap. You give up a 3-run homer. You have a really bad-looking line. I mean, Miles Michaelis doesn't have a lot of room for error. Kyle Gibson, I think we're going to ride the roller coaster. So I don't know. I think overall, though, still, I would say the rotation's a little better than I thought. And I never thought the rotation was going to be good. I was hoping it wasn't going to be in the 20s. I mean, if it's middle of the pack with a good bullpen and a good offense, I think they're okay. The offense sucks right now. But what do you think about the rotation? Because to me, it's, like I said, slightly better than what I expected.
You've gotten everything you could have hoped out of the rotation, in my opinion. You had Miles get beat up by the Dodgers in the first game. Terrible matchup for him, in my opinion, with the lefties that can slug in that lineup, and he pitches to contact. Their contact tends to travel. So I just didn't think it would be a great matchup for him. In the 2 games that he's pitched since, he's had a quality start. 6 innings, 2 runs. 6 2/3, 2 runs. I know his ERA is 4.7. That's because of the first game. I like what you've gotten from Michael. Steven Matz, they've managed him really well. I think it's okay. If you're only getting 5 or 5 1/3 out of Matz, if it's a good 5, then you take that. Lynn has pitched well despite the different circumstances of the, it seems like it's pouring down rain every time he has to pitch. So I think all things considered, I'm pretty cool with the performance you've gotten from him so far. And Gibson had the one really good game. And then I do think it matters that he had in his second game that was so bad, he still threw you 6 innings. I know people are tired of hearing about that, but I'm telling you, it was part of what the Cardinals envisioned for their offseason when they said, we just need to be able to save our bullpen. And it absolutely came into play in the Philly series this week. You didn't win the games because of your offense. But if you look at the fact that they didn't have to use anybody prominent on Sunday because Gibby, my guy, went 6 instead of going 2 2/3 and giving up 7 runs, he went 6. The fact that you had basically your full complement on Monday, game that you lose in extra innings, but to me, the offense is to blame for that a little bit because you only scored 3 runs. That game probably didn't have to go to extra innings if you can win it 4-3. So the relievers pitched pretty well. Helsley gave up a chopper down the line by Alec Bohm that it happens sometimes. And when they start a guy on second base automatically, you lose. I didn't have any problem with Ryan Helsley. And then he was lights out the next time he came out to pitch. You get the win on Tuesday. The bullpen is lights out. Wednesday, Pallante is the one guy that gives something up. But again, with the circumstances of Sonny Gray at 65 pitches and day game after a night game, you were a little bit limited as it was in this series from a bullpen perspective. It would have been so much worse if Kyle Gibson doesn't do what he does on Sunday. So I know people don't like to hear about how it matters that a guy is still able to get you 6 and 8 innings. I think it matters, and it would have mattered even more. We'd be singing the praises even more of Kyle Gibson if not for the offense having such a rough series against Philly. Because if they score 4 or 5 runs a game instead of 3, Cardinals end up probably winning 2 or 3 or even sweeping that series. And we go, it's a damn good thing that Kyle Gibson was able to save the bullpen like he did. Because they didn't really reap the full benefits of it, people probably don't care. But I'm telling you, that's what the Cardinals envisioned. He did what they envisioned. And so for me, 1 through 5 in the rotation, I don't think you could ask for much more than they've given you so far. And if it's sustainable, offense comes around, this is going to be a good team. But is it sustainable? In the same way that we say the offense won't be as bad through 13 games, what's the rotation? Is this going to be something they can keep up the whole way?
Right. And we're not going to be results oriented here on this podcast. I don't think either of us are.
Not this one. We'll do it on another podcast.
There you go. But I understand how it plays on social media. And I like to kind of jump in and just watch the show, because you do know what's going to happen. And this gets back to reasonable people, both things can be true at the same time, which is Kyle Gibson was horrible in the first inning on Sunday. He cost them that game, but it was helpful for him to go 6 innings. And going 6 innings did set up the Cardinals really well from a usage standpoint to have success in the Phillies series. But as you mentioned, it was more of an offensive issue. And this, to me, gets back to last year, which was, and I know we always bring up Waino, but it wasn't just Waino. It was whether it was, the Woodfords of the world or Dakota Hudson. The Cardinals were having starts last year that were so bad. They didn't just lose on Sunday. It caused a loss on a Monday and a Tuesday because they were going 3 1/3, 3 2/3, bullpen tax. You can't use this guy the next day. So at minimum, I agree, Kyle Gibson going 6, you didn't lose any games beyond Sunday. Yes, you lost Sunday because of Kyle Gibson, but he still set you up for success. It's not his fault that the offense sucked over the next 3 days against the fighting Phils.
Yeah, and last year, like, it was also some guys that are still in the rotation. Like, Steven Matz had a handful of 4-inning outings when he was pitching so poorly at the beginning of the season, and some of that happened where they lost on subsequent days because of a guy like Matz. Now, did they change anything because of that? No, they said, hey, Matz is still going to be in the rotation. They just were banking on a better version of Matz, and so far through 2 games, small sample, they're getting it. But yeah, that's why the Cardinals went the way that they went in the offseason. They signed these veterans that they thought, these guys are just going to go 6 and they're going to eat these innings, and we're not going to end up with the bullpen. Like, you can look at your top 5 relievers in the bullpen, and if you would say, that's an A reliever, that's an A reliever, that's an A-minus reliever, that's a B-plus reliever, those guys ended up performing all kind of like C to C-plus relievers because of the amount that they were asked to fill. The Cardinals are saying, look, our rotation might just be a C or a C-plus, but if we've got A relievers out there, they're going to have the opportunity to perform like A relievers because they're not going to be used as often as they were last year or in the circumstances that they were, where it said, hey, you're not really a multi-inning guy, but you got to throw 2 today because we simply need you to. And if that doesn't work, we're going to lose this game too. Like, it sets up better if the rotation continues to give them the sort of length that we've seen through a couple of weeks.
Early on here, Cardinals in last place, but it's, look, 13 games in, they're 6-7.
Can't catch
anything
the Pirates.
In the Central. That's the thing. The Pirates, are we really believing the 9-3 Pirates? Those scrappy Brewers, they always find a way to be competitive.
Yeah.
8-3, Cubs 7-5, Reds 6-6. You can make the argument that kind of, I think, what a lot of people expected to happen in the Central, you could almost flip the standings. Now, maybe Reds, Cubs, not exactly, but they're so close right now. But the Pirates have had good starts before last season. I don't know if they have staying power, but I don't know. Also, it's really, for me, it's way too early. Like, you have to turn through the rotation to me like 4, 5, 6 times before I even really start to even begin to make any type of conclusions.
Yeah, I don't think right now looking at the division and saying, oh, the Cardinals are cooked because they're in last. I mean, it's been a couple of weeks to this point. But, I mean, to the credit of the Pirates, they're getting offensive contributions from guys that we know are good, like Brian Reynolds and O'Neill Cruz. But they're getting the pitching. And they haven't even called up Paul Skeens yet. That's the thing. Like, when they call up Paul Skeens, who's been lighting up AAA, there is a world in which maybe their pitching sustains itself too. Like, I think the Pirates can finish at or above 500 this year. I don't know about a 9-3 pace that they're on right now, but you look at last year, I think they won like 76 games. We always mentally sort of catalog the Pirates as just being terrible, dreadful, 100 loss. They weren't that last year. They finished better than the Cardinals by a handful of games. They've got young players that maybe are another year into their careers, so perhaps they continue to perform. I think you're going to have to overcome at least a, you know, 81, 82 win Pirates team unless the bottom totally drops out of it. Other teams in the division, the Brewers might not be terrible. Like they did trade Burns, and so everybody kind of looked at it and said, oh, they're selling. I think that was a unique circumstance because they knew they couldn't re-sign him, but they still signed Rhys Hoskins. They still went out and made other moves to try and be in the mix. They kind of did what everybody accuses the Cardinals of doing for the most part, which is just do enough to kind of be in the mix at the end and see. They could finish 500, and I think the Cubs and Reds could too. I don't know if there's a truly bad team in this division, but are there any great ones? The Cardinals might kind of luck out with the fact that there might not be any great ones. The Cardinals could be that team if the offense could get going, because I think what you've seen from the pitching is enough to get them there if you have a top 10 offense. But like you said, 23rd in OPS, that's where they are. Is it where they're going to be? Maybe not. But if it is, if that's where they stay, it's not going to cut it. So I think we can all be honest about that.
One of my favorite parts about Cardinal fandom is the angst slash celebration when you see players leave the organization and then do really well. And we'll get to Tyler O'Neill. I did a little bit of my take on him yesterday, and I want to talk to you about that as well. But I think because the outfielder thing, we've done that now for 5 years.
That's old
and
news.
It's part of a big bucket of outfielders that we'll discuss. But the Jordan Hicks thing, I think, is really interesting too.
Yes.
So if folks don't know, so in three starts, he's 2-0, 18 innings, only 13 strikeouts, but not walking, folks. His whip is 0.8. And this just kind of gets back to the development of pitching. Now, we know that Jordan Hicks was a big-time reliever when healthy, throwing 105, 106, really, really good reliever. But the fact that this guy could be a really good starter, and I think we both know the value of a really good starter is so much greater, especially if he's your own guy. You don't have to pay him for a while. Now, that's not the same situation. But it's just the fact that why early on is he having this success with the Giants as a starter? Remember, the Cardinals gave him a little bit of a shot as kind of a quasi-opener a couple years ago. But, you know, we've talked about this with Helsley. You know, could Helsley have been a good starter? Trevor Rosenthal always said he wished he could have been a starter. Who knows if Rosie could have been a good starter? We'll never really know the answer to that. But I think it's fascinating when you see a guy that the Cardinals early on said, you're a reliever, now freaking 6-7 years later, becoming a damn good starter.
Yeah, and I think you have to look organizationally at the way that they've approached it. It's always been, hey, you can have a guy come up as a reliever, and then it doesn't exclude him from being a starter down the road. But the caveat to that is it does exclude you in the Cardinals world if you throw 100, because they're never gonna put you back. They haven't been able to necessarily find the relievers to say, we don't need this guy who can throw 100 to be in our bullpen right now. We can afford to, we have the luxury to leave him in Memphis. We can have him develop as a starter. We can wait. They haven't really taken that approach. It's always been, get him up here, because otherwise who's throwing the eighth? Who's throwing the ninth? And those guys end up doing really well at that because, well, they throw 100. But it is kind of one of those things that I think they just have taken for granted because of how good historically their defense has been. I think it's always been, pitch to contact in the starter is not so bad. We need guys who throw strikes. Those are the guys who are starters, because if you don't throw strikes, you can't get deeper into games. You can't throw six innings. Throw strikes, let your defense back you up, and then we'll have, when the game's on the line in the eighth and ninth, those guys who throw 100 can come out and be your closers. I think that pretty much sums up the way the Cardinals have done it historically, and you can even look at the way they've drafted in somewhat recent years. Michael McGreevy is a guy that they picked in the first round. Why? Because he had great command through strikes. But does he have the upside to get into a rotation at the big league level and be a number two or be an ace? I don't think many people have him pegged for that. And that's a development thing, but it's also a drafting thing. Like, are they willing to go after the raw prospects that can turn into stars? Tink Hentz is a guy that I think people hope can turn into that. That was a unique circumstance, though, when they picked him in 2020, because they took a bunch of high school guys because college seasons didn't happen. And they said, we might as well zig where we would usually zag, because we don't really know a lot about these college players anyway. Let's draft a Jordan Walker. Let's draft a Mason Winn and a Tink Hentz, and let's go for upside. And what do you know? Like, even though Walker's kind of struggling right now, I think everybody looks at that draft as being the one you can hang your hat on in recent years for the Cardinals. So it is a deep conversation that I think we could take 2 hours and explain it instead of just a 1-hour podcast, where it's like, do do the Cardinals need to look at things a little bit differently and maybe not pigeonhole a guy into a bullpen role just because he can objectively thrive in it today? What are you costing the team down the road? Because, man, having that starter throwing on $750,000 who can be more than just like a Zach Thompson, maybe he's a number six, maybe he's a number five. Like, a lot of these guys have a guy come up and they're great and you're not paying them, and that gives you the luxury to then be a little bit aggressive in free agency. When a Jordan Montgomery's price falls and he doesn't take 4 years to sign, boom, now you can afford that luxury. The Cardinals have perennially been in a spot where they don't feel they can do that because they're just having to backfill for $11 million in free agency. But what's interesting is they could have done this with Hicks if they wanted to, right? He signed the Steven Matz contract, identical, 4 years, $44 million. And the Giants, I think, are one of the best teams in baseball at getting the most out of pitchers and saying, hey, throw this pitch a little bit more. Take a little bit off this one. Here's what you need to do. The Giants deserve credit for if this is sustainable for Jordan Hicks having a one ERA through three starts. The Giants are going to deserve a lot of credit for that. It's always what Jordan wanted to do, but for whatever reason, it's that change of scenery thing, just like with the outfielders. Ah, they needed a change of scenery. Why is it always from St. Louis? Why is that the scenery that all these guys are getting the change of, and then they're going out elsewhere and performing? It's a little bit of a bummer when you can look internally and go, ah, they don't have that guy that they've been able to develop as a starter and get that type of performance from. It's, you throw your hands up, man. That's all you can do. But I think it is a deep conversation that you could look organizationally and go, why does this keep happening? Why is this something that took place again with a guy who came up as a starter and thrived until you said, yeah, let's make him a reliever?
Right. And I think that is what is important to note about Jordan Hicks, that sometimes we forget unless you go back there. You know, sometimes you understand, like, look at Zach Thompson, for example. Zach Thompson, towards the end, I don't want to say of his minor league career, but he was struggling as a starter to a point where maybe it opens up the conversation, do we turn him into a reliever? Jordan Hicks was different. Jordan Hicks, I'm looking right now, in 2016 in 12 starts in A-ball rookie, 2.97 ERA. The next year, two teams, A and advanced A, 2.74, 19 starts. He was very young. He was a successful starter in the minors on that trend, but they put him into the bullpen immediately and he became a reliever and he never really got that shot again besides the 1 year with the weird opener. He also had, look, maybe if you were going to give him another shot, remember he had the COVID, obviously, where he opted out. He had Tommy John. He had some weird stuff. But with what you're saying, I think is very interesting about not just pitchers, more so outfielders. We'll get to Tyler O'Neill. Why is the change of scenery always working when they leave? Why are we not getting that positive bump in the change of scenery when people come here? And remember, I say we, as Cardinal Nation, we had that for years with Dave Duncan. So if you don't think that's possible, that Dave Duncan can take some of these reclamation projects, guys that throw hard four-seamers, turn them into two-seamers, sinker slider, pitch to contact. I mean, for 10, 15 years, we saw the Cardinals use that coaching staff advantage. It seems like the Cardinals no longer have that, and other teams do. Hicks, the outfielders, I don't even know what the outfielders, if it's coaching, if it's more as developing, understanding what you have before you let that person walk, you know?
Yeah, I would say, though, like, there are examples where you could say they've had guys come here and then their career does take off, but it's mostly been the ones that come to mind for me anyway, a very specific type of trade that gets made. It's a guy that's extra on your bench that you trade for sort of a middling reliever that's not totally proven or that's not, you know, an obvious closer, and then he comes. Giovanni Gallegos is an example of that. They traded Edmundo Sosa to get JoJo, and JoJo has now established himself as a guy that you can rely upon in late innings in St. Louis. And so, like, those are the examples where I would say, like, credit to the Cardinals for identifying and making those types of trades. You trade Luke Voit, you get back a guy who's a staple in your bullpen for 5 years. Kittredge for Palacios is another one that it's very, very early, but I think we both are looking at that deal going, yeah, that's pretty good the way the Cardinals were able to get another reliable arm into their bullpen. But yeah, they haven't really necessarily done that too frequently. It's because I think with position player trades, they try to squeeze out every last bit of value. And if a guy has trade value in a moment, they're whether it's gun-shy or just unwillingness because, well, why would we trade a guy who's playing well? There's never that type. Like, I don't think anybody could find me that kind of trade where you've had a guy who's a starter or a regular on the team and the Cardinals make the bold decision to trade them at the height of their value to make a bet almost that, hey, this guy's a good player, but this is probably the height of the value that we're going to have for him. Even when you make a good trade of Bader for Jordan Montgomery, Bader was not at the height of his value, right? He had been injured. They had a chance once upon a time to do that deal for Zach Wheeler, right? Like, Bader was one of the outfielders that maybe when he was, what was it, with the Mets or whoever it was back in the day, that was a deal that maybe was on the table, could have been made. The Cardinals go, eh, you know, we don't want to trade Bader. We think he's our future. He's our present and our future. You can make the case with Dylan Carlson that when he had a height of his value, the Cardinals said, well, no, if he does that for the next decade, we want that guy extended and here and playing daily. But they haven't been able to ever make that trade that's a little bit bold where you extract the most value that you can. This offseason that just happened, people maybe advocated for Nolan Gorman to be a guy they do that with. Is it risky? Hell yeah, guy could hit 40 homers. But like you said, is he ever going to put it together, be average, batting average guy who also slugs and gets on base and does everything? Like, the Cardinals haven't made those types of deals. So when you talk about change of scenery, it seems like they're usually, Tyler O'Neill, great example, trading the guy after they've tried it and tried it and tried it, and for whatever reason it wasn't working here, rather than, hey, you know what, this guy has a skill set that we might be able to acquire something we need for, and maybe privately, we just don't know if this guy is cut out for it. We think we might be in the optimal moment to sell on this player. That's never been a move that Mosellock's front office, I think, has been willing to do. And it's hard to say that as a criticism because we can't tell the future out here. We're wrong all the time about guys and say, oh, you got to get him off this team. And then Lane Thomas turns into a competent major league outfielder for a number of years in Washington. So we as the public don't always know, but I always kind of like to say, yeah, but it's their job to know. Like, over time, mm-hmm. You're going to be graded and judged on how often you execute those types of deals and get the most for your talent. So it's a mild criticism. I don't want to go overboard and say, yeah, the front office stinks. They've had some good success. But in that area in particular, it's interesting that it's always kind of 1 year late that they seem to be unloading these guys. And O'Neill, they were done with him. They said, we're going to get what we can for him. And everybody knew he'd go to Boston, and if he's healthy, he'd be good. So here we are.
Yeah, I think, to me, it's just the trend. The trend line is low. I don't remember anything, John Mosellock having any mistakes like this his first 11 years. The last five or so, there's been a lot of them. And like you said, give credit for the JoJo's, for the Geo's. You know, he's been very savvy, usually, in the Asian market. If you go back to
Michaelis,
whether it was Michaelis, you know, Soon Won Oh, KK, obviously, you know, our guy, what was his name? Drew
Verhagen.
Hagen.
Drew
didn't work out.
They tried, you know, it was a low risk signing.
But again, savvy moves in the Asian market, savvy to pick up some of those nice, solid relievers that you mentioned. But it's just different when it's, I mean, all star. Cy Young, MVP type guys that for whatever reason, I don't even want to get into why every single one of these people left, but it is Sandy Alcantara, Zach Gallen, guys, Cy Young caliber. We'll see what happens with Jordan Hicks, but Randy Arozarena, Adolis Garcia, all-star MVP vote caliber. We know Tyler O'Neill is MVP vote caliber. My thing with Tyler O'Neill is, look, doesn't surprise me, but it won't surprise me if he gets hurt. It won't surprise me if he doesn't have a great year next year. My thing with Tyler is different because no matter what anybody wants to say, okay, did Ollie not lose the clubhouse last year? Sure, I'll agree with that. He for sure lost Tyler O'Neill. I'll tell you that. And Tyler O'Neill admitted that on Foul Territory. It became relationship, he called it, respect at arm's length. So, you know, Ollie, if you had to call him out, you had to call it his manhood, you had to call out his effort, right? You lost the player to a point where you had to trade him. I understand trading him, but you traded a dude in a walk year that you know has the potential in any given year to be an MVP caliber player, and you got a reliever that's not on your big league roster for him. And I think that's a big part of this. At the end of Tyler O'Neill, you essentially had to break up the relationship because of the way he was treated. And let's be real, you didn't get very much for him. Now, if Nick Robertson becomes JoJo or Gio in the next couple of years, I'll change my mind on that. But right now, you got one guy. I mean, Tyler O'Neill leads the league in everything right now, literally. on base 489, slug 857, OPS 1346, OPS plus 282, six bombs, 13 runs. I don't think it's going to continue. I think the Tyler one is very complex, but I do think the way Ollie handled the base running thing last year ruined that relationship for the future.
Yeah. I mean, I think that played a part in it. I also think, though, for the Cardinals, it's like you said, well, why does it keep happening that the outfielders, like, they keep choosing the wrong ones, basically. Mm-hmm. They keep backing the wrong horse. And it's uncanny that it keeps happening the way that it's happened. But I think the change of scenery factor is one that maybe there's always going to be a benefit to that guy who goes elsewhere with a chip on his shoulder because he didn't get the playing time or didn't, even if it wasn't a case of adversarial relationship with management, maybe just didn't get the playing time. Like Adolis Garcia never really got a shot. Rosarena never really got a full scale shot for more than a few games at a time. And so that can propel a player perhaps to say, oh, I'll show them. Like, I don't know. I haven't asked those guys that, but is that maybe in the back of their mind at some point in the early goings of their career? I wouldn't doubt it for a second. So like that contributes to it as well. But it's just like, if you've got five outfielders in a given, a given spring or a given season where you say, hey, next year we got to trim this to four, they continue to say, well, they wanted Libertor. They thought, hey, we've done this thing at developing starters where we kind of sort of stink at it. So maybe this guy who was a first round pick, we can get him. He's a lefty. He's lanky. He throws hard. Like, this is what we need. And right now, if we're going to say we've got five outfielders, a Rosarena might be the third best one. And we might even think that internally, but they're making a trade with us like he's our best player. So we need to go ahead and do this deal because we're going to get something that we don't have for something that we feel like we've got plenty of. And it's just uncanny that they keep then the guys that are in their outfield keep kind of underperforming by 10% or 8%. And then the guy that they thought was maybe their, even if they thought internally that he was better than Bader or better than who, at the time Carlson or whoever it was, they say, well, they're asking, this is the guy that can get this deal done and we need a Libertor. And then the guy that's the Libertor doesn't end up filling the role. It's not that everybody just stinks that they acquire. It's like they're a little bit underwhelming. And the guy that they could have kept and put their arms around and said, you're our dude, let's go see it. They said it to somebody else who was, maybe he performed like right around league average, like a Dylan Carlson, but he's not great. And a Rosarena is, and Adolis is, and these other guys are great when they get those opportunities elsewhere. So I know Mozeliak is tired of hearing about it. He made the joke in December when he was asked at the winter meetings, like, yeah, you got a little bit of a surplus on the outfield. You're looking to trade one of these guys. You've had a Rosarena's happen to you. You've had a Adolis Garcia's happen to you. Are you a little bit worried about that notion? He said, yeah, whoever we trade's probably going to get MVP votes. That was a direct quote. Like, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy at this point, and the Cardinals can't get away from it. It's uncanny, but it's 2024, and we're still talking about it with one of these outcast outfielders.
Yeah, and Adolis Garcia, to me, different, late bloomer, everybody had a shot at him. Randy Arozarena is the main one because you never gave him an opportunity. And look, the Rays don't make a lot of mistakes. So I'd also be thinking, well, wait, why did the Rays want this guy so bad that we've never given a shot in the big leagues, but he's been great in the minors? And why are the Rays so ready to punt on Libertor a couple years in, a first round pick? Like, let's think about that too. They usually don't make mistakes on the level we've seen the Cardinals make the last several years. I think with Tyler O'Neill, what bugs me about that, and I think this plays a lot into it in organizations. If a player is drafted, if there's people in that room that are still in the organization that drafted that guy, they always see the best in him. They don't want to move those guys because it's a bad look when your big time draft pick doesn't pan out. And that's probably why somebody like Dylan Carlson is always going to get 5,000 opportunities. Right? Because, oh, he's their guy. He was the number one pick. There's people in the organization. They all vouch for him. Tyler O'Neill came in a trade. It's different. Tyler O'Neill, he had the great year. He was always hurt. He had the thing with Ollie. My thing is, with Tyler, though, we saw it. We saw an eighth in the MVP season. We have never seen anything like that from Dylan Carlson, and he gets 5,000 opportunities.
Yeah, but I would say this, like, they came into last year not doing it that way. Tyler is the guy that got opportunities to begin last year. They even said, you're going to be the center fielder. Now, it went so horrifically bad within a week that you look back and he only played center field like 10 times in the season. Like, it wasn't, it didn't end the year that way. But Dylan was kind of the guy that on paper was boxed out coming into the year because the Cardinals said, look, this guy, Tyler, is coming on. You know, he's a couple of years from being able to walk. We know what the raw material says. We could use a guy that can lock down and stabilize center field while hitting the way that he can, because then you can play an upcoming Lars Nootbaar in the corner, or you can play some of these other guys like Burleson and you know, maybe they thought ahead to Jordan Walker. That guy can play in the corner, and we've got a center fielder that's just doing it all. We got a star out there. So they tried to make Tyler O'Neill happen in St. Louis, at least initially, but like you said, sometimes behind the scenes there might be some friction where, hey, we spent a first-round pick on this other guy. Are we really going to – and then all he sees what he perceives as a lack of hustle in the first week of the season, and he goes, this is ridiculous. I'm really having to play this guy, and this is what he's given me. Like, I'm not saying that's exactly what happened, but you can sort of see how that would be framed for a manager when internally, organizationally, they might be looking at other guys going, this is really what I'd rather do, but we kind of feel like we're tied to this other thing. So that's maybe where some of that friction can develop to. It is a really interesting conversation. It's kind of beating a dead horse at the same time, but when the horse keeps being revived every summer, it's like we still have to keep talking about it because it's the same story, but with a new player each and every time it happens.
And a crazy one. I'm not predicting this, but if this were to happen with Dylan Carlson too,
oh dude,
in a year or two,
I need it. I crave it. I really
right.
do.
No, it's
because I like Dylan Carlson. I want him to do well.
No, so do I. I just think with Tyler O'Neill, it's the Cardinals' fault in the relationship that it got to this point. It's Tyler's fault in always being hurt, and it is Tyler's fault. He should have hustled, but with 1 year left in his walk year, it got to a point that you needed a change of scenery so bad that you had to move him, and every other team knew you were leveraged and you didn't get anything, relatively speaking, for him. I think if you'd have traded him for an Andrew Kittredge,
yeah,
people would have understood. But it got to a point where the value was essentially gone. And I think that's what people have now seen with Dylan Carlson. You did the same thing now with Dylan Carlson, probably.
And the difference between Tyler and Carlson is, like you said, even though Carlson had a 780 OPS 1 year, which is pretty good, that's like the Nootbaar. Like if Nootbaar continues to have 780, 800 OPS, you're like, wow, Lars Nootbaar is great. But then you go, well, that's still not an 850 OPS. Like, what is Lars Nootbaar? And is he ever going to stay healthy? Like that, you don't ever want that to be the next conversation. But 2 years ago, or even like last year, you go, well, Lars Nootbaar, obviously he's the present and the future. I mean, he's a superstar, but like until you see those numbers and those are the guys that you're putting your weight behind to be able to play every day, those guys have to turn into great and not, 109 OPS plus, which is pretty good. Whatever Newt's was, 114, like that's pretty good. But yeah, you're kind of ultimately, there's only three spots in that outfield. And then you deal with the DH too. You've got to figure out a way to prioritize the right guys. And they continued to kind of not make that happen. And with O'Neill, almost out of spite, like it's easy to say now because he's looking great. And I knew they were trading him. Like I knew they wouldn't get to camp and he would be on that team. It wasn't tenable. But almost
he said Mozeliak.
He did. And so when Mo says it publicly, you know it's not. I mean, it was just automatic. He was going to be dealt for anything they could get. And Nick Robertson in a minor league pitcher that we won't see for a while ends up being the answer to that. Almost out of spite, said, screw it. We're not letting this happen again, even though this situation is not tenable. It's like, Tyler, you're sticking here and you'll either play or you won't or whatever will happen, but we will not let this happen again. When they knew they were almost trading him as like a kind of like a pseudo salary dump because they weren't going to get a difference maker necessarily for him at that point because of where the value had gotten. I think there are some Cardinals fans who would go, out of spite, they should have just said, like, not spite toward Tyler, but spite toward their past mistakes. It's like, we physically will not allow this to happen again with this guy. And it was like a situation tailor-made for it to happen when you look at the raw materials that O'Neill is dealing with. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer would have been. Clubhouse stuff matters too. And if it wasn't tenable in the clubhouse, then it wasn't tenable in the clubhouse. But like you said, is that really all on Tyler that wasn't the case? Like, these are fair topics in my opinion.
All right, well said, Brendan. We're at about an hour here. I'm not going to lie. I have to pee.
Hey, that's fair.
Hey, we're going to end it. But hey, it was the right time to end it anyway. So, Brendan, B. Schaefer, Daily.
The right time to end this relationship with this podcast. Was there maybe more in the tank? Yeah, possibly. But it was the right time to end it. You had to end it somewhere. That was like a reference to Tyler O'Neill and the Cardinals. Anyway, I went for it. It's okay. If it didn't land, that's all right. Look at that.
My notes?
Yeah.
We hit on everything.
Oh, we did it then.
I had nothing else.
You had notes? Man.
Well, as I go, as yeah. I go, you know?
Okay.
All right.
This is good.
Well, follow Be Shafe Daily and follow and comment, like, subscribe this channel. Share the videos. Put them on social media. Put them in your group text with your Cardinals fans and friends. And let's grow this bad boy, Brendan. All right. Good job, buddy.
I say let's grow it. Yeah, baby.